taking a look at the 7th and 10th commandments, thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. The principle here is that property belongs to its rightful owner, and any deliberate infringement of justice regarding rightful ownership demands what we call restitution. There are two main sins against the 7th commandment: stealing and unjust damage. We all know what stealing is. It's when you take something that belongs to another and the owner is reasonably unwilling for it to be taken from him. This also includes opening the mail of another, eavesdropping on a private conversation, and nowadays hacking into someone's computer. This will all be sinful, with the exception for parents. Parents of minor children, dear parents, if your minor child is receiving mail that you suspect is coming from someone they should not be in contact with, you may open your minor child's mail. And if you know how to hack into your minor child's computer, go ahead and hack. Doesn't that give you a sense of parental empowerment? Pirating CDs, DVDs, and software, etc., will ordinarily be sinful because it is defrauding the manufacturer, even if it is a multi-billion dollar company like Microsoft. Time wasted at work or sick time falsely claimed will ordinarily be sinful, and a good way to put to make up for sins from the workplace is to put in some extra time at work without claiming for it. We do have an obligation to pay our just debts, and that includes credit card debts. Now, sometimes the only option left is to declare bankruptcy. If you're ever stuck in this place, make sure that you speak to a priest first to make sure that you're not doing something unjust. Regarding taxes, tax evasion, and the IRS, I won't speak about this directly from the pulpit, but if you ever have any questions, simply speak to a priest. Besides the first sin of theft, the second sin against the 7th commandment is unjust damage. So this is deliberate damage or destruction of another person's property. This will be mortal or venial depending upon the damage done. So $150 worth of damage or destruction is considered mortally sinful because one day's wage of an average worker is considered grave matter. Less than $100 worth would normally be considered venial. However, the circumstances of the owner must be taken into account. For example, if I steal $5 from someone who is genuinely poor, yeah, that'll be a mortal sin. Restitution is the reparation that we make for sins of theft or unjust damage. If the original theft or damage was mortally sinful, then the restitution itself obliges under pain of mortal sin. If the original theft or damage was venial, then the restitution obliges under pain of venial sin. For example, let's say that I steal a candy bar that's worth, what, $2.50 now? So that's a venial sin. Either I have to give the candy bar back to the person or store I stole it from, or if I've already eaten it, then I have to return $2.50. And if I deliberately don't restitute for my sin of theft, then I've committed a second sin on top of the first one. Now, who do you make restitution to? If you know who the owner is, normally you would restitute to the owner, even if it is a company, an insurance business, a neighbor, whoever. If you still possess a stolen good, you must return it. If you no longer possess it, you must return its equivalent or its monetary equivalent. However, normally you are not obliged to say what you have done. In most cases, you may restitute as a gift or a donation. Let's give a couple examples. Let's say that you've stolen a CD or DVD from a store. What you can do is go to the store and then buy a gift certificate for the amount of the thing that you stole, and then you rip up the gift certificate, throw it out so it can't be used by anyone. That way you have anonymously restored the money to the proper owner. Let's give another example. Let's say that when you were a child, you used to steal money from your parents, and now that you're 20 years old, you're too embarrassed to tell your folks what you did. What you can do is get your parents a really nice Christmas card and put some money in it and put something like, you know, love you lots, mom and dad, hugs and kisses from your favorite child. Again, that way you've got the money back to them. Only if you really don't know who the owner was or you don't know where they live, in this case, you are allowed to restitute to the poor. If there is no poor box in the church, you may then restitute to the church in the Sunday collection plate. Another good thing is for restitution is also sending it to a pious cause. For example, the seminary or a convent. For example, the teaching Dominican sisters or teaching Franciscan sisters. I also encourage people to send money to the orphanages out in India, Paliyamkottai, India. The SSPX fathers run the boys' orphanage, and then the Consoling Sisters run the girls' orphanage. I was there in 2014, I think it was, and I was really impressed with the good work that they're doing out there in those orphanages. And in the American dollars go a long way in India. Even like $100 is like more than $1,000 worth over there. So it really does help them in those orphanages in India. Now, there are also causes that can excuse you from making restitution. For example, if the owner forgives you your debt, you are permanently excused. That's actually what happens in a bankruptcy. The obligation to restitute can be temporarily suspended if restituting would put yourself or your family in financial difficulty. The first rule about restitution is that you do not damage your family finances. In this case, it is best to restitute in segments if possible. For example, let's say that you owe someone $1,000. You keep a tally and, you know, mark it off $50 this month, $50 next month, until you've actually paid the debt off. However, occasionally it happens where someone has, you know, let's say defrauded their insurance company to the tune of what? You know, $250,000. Well, how many of us have that much money in our pockets? If we did, we'd all own yellow Lamborghinis. In this case, the best thing you can do is try to restitute in segments as best as you can, and then you pray to win the lottery. Now, lying is always sinful, mortal, or venial, depending upon the damage done. Moreover, if you lie to someone who has a right to the truth, for example, if you lie to your boss about work-related things, if you lie to your spouse about things that your spouse has a right to know about, if as a minor child you lie to your parents, this is not only a sin against truth, but it's also a sin against justice as well. However, please note, it is okay to be evasive with someone who does not have a strict right to the truth. So let's give a couple examples. Let's say that you're a wife at home sitting with your husband when the phone rings and is a telemarketer, and you know your husband doesn't want to talk to her. So you say, "I'm sorry, but Mr. Smith isn't at home right now." This is not considered a lie, even though he's sitting right next to you. Everyone knows what this means. It's simply a polite way of saying, "He doesn't want to talk to you, get lost." That's okay. It is not a lie. It is not sinful. St. Alphonsus de Liguori also gives another example of this in his moral theology. He says, let's suppose that you've been invited over to dinner at someone's house. They made dinner specially for you, and it was rather awful. And your hostess asks, "How did you like my cooking?" St. Alphonsus says that you can say, "It was wonderful," meaning for my mortification. This is evasion. It is not a lie. However, one is never allowed to tell a direct lie under any circumstances. That brings us to the eighth commandment, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." The principle here is that everyone is entitled to his good name. Now, the gravity of sins against fraternal charity is weighed according to the damage done to a person's reputation. So, if you destroy a person's reputation without necessity, this is a mortal sin. If you simply damage a person's reputation without destroying it, this will be a venial sin. Personally, after 25 years of priesthood, I think that among traditional Catholics, at least, mortal sin version of detraction is fortunately quite rare. The venial form, of course, is quite common, which is what we want to watch out for, though. Now, calumny or slander means telling lies about someone, whereas detraction, what we oftentimes call gossiping, means telling the unflattering truth about someone behind their back unnecessarily. Now, please note that we say unnecessarily, because there are times when it is appropriate for us to speak about the real faults of others. The old theologians mention three cases in particular where it's okay. First case is between husband and wife. Husband and wife can discuss anyone together. You can discuss what is happening in the family, in the workplace, in the parish, in the school, in the neighborhood. It's not gossip. So husband and wife, you can discuss anyone together. Now, you do want to avoid bitterness. That could become venial. And you also want to avoid talking in front of the little kids. That wouldn't be right. But in and of itself, husband and wife can discuss anyone together. Second case is where you are venting to a discreet friend or coworker, because in this case, you're not doing this to damage a person's reputation. No, you're doing this because you need to get some encouragement, get some advice how to handle a difficult situation. That's okay. That is not gossip. Likewise, it's okay for you to listen to someone who is not just gossiping, but who actually does need just someone to listen to them, to get some encouragement, and then give them some good advice. Now, a third case where it's okay to speak about the real faults of another is where you are trying to prevent harm to a third party. Let's give a couple examples. Let's say that you're talking to your Novus Ordo Catholic friend about the crisis in the church, trying to convince your friend that Catholic tradition is the answer. And so you tell your Novus Ordo friend about the terrible things that Cardinal Mahoney, was doing in Los Angeles for more than 25 years, even though you have just destroyed whatever reputation the cardinal might have had to begin with. You're not doing it for that reason. You're doing it to help your friend be able to come to terms with the crisis in the church. That's actually an act of charity. Let's give another example. Let's say that you know that Joe Sixpack is a notorious womanizer, and you see your friend's daughter going out on a date with Joe. You can go to your friend and just tell your friend exactly what Joe is. Even though you've just destroyed Joe's reputation, you're not doing it for that reason. You're doing it to protect the girl and her family. Again, that's an act of charity. There's a special rule concerning fraternal charity. We must judge people's actions. We must judge their behaviors. If someone does something that's dumb, stupid, or sinful, we can't pretend it's not. But at the same time that we must judge people's actions, we must not judge their intentions, because only God can do that. So instead of judging the intentions, we should try to excuse their intentions, even if we cannot excuse their behaviors. And by doing this, we are being both realistic, what they've done is sinful or stupid, and yet also charitable and merciful, maybe they didn't know any better. Concerning forgiveness, we must forgive our enemies from our heart, although we may need to insist that they make restitution for what they've done against us, our families, or our business. Please notice that forgiveness, like any other virtue, is not in the feelings. It's an act of the will. That's why forgiveness, like any other virtue, can coexist with clenched teeth. As long as we can say, "Dear Jesus, I want to forgive him, even if I feel like I don't," that does actually count as an act of forgiveness. That brings us now to the precepts of the church, of which there are six. The first precept concerns the laws of fast and abstinence. Fasting means one full meal during the day plus two smaller meals not equal to a full meal. This is now officially from age 18, no longer from age 21 is what it used to be, and now goes to be precise, the last day you are obliged to fast is the day after your 59th birthday. But Father, why would it be the day after your 59th birthday? It'd take me too long to explain this really peculiar aspect of canon law, so just take it from me. Okay. Now, Ash Wednesday and the Good Friday, these are the only 2 days of the year that are strictly obligatory days of fast now. The weekdays of Lent are still strongly recommended, but it is no longer sinful. Abstinence is either complete or partial. It's complete when you have no meat during the day. It's partial when you can eat meat once in the day. This is now officially from age 14, though traditionally it was from age 7. Ash Wednesday and the 7 Fridays of Lent are still strictly obligatory days of abstinence from meat here in the United States. We are not allowed to trade out a different penance on those days. It would be mortally sinful to eat meat on those days. The other Fridays of the year are still strongly recommended, but it is allowed now to do a different penance, for example, saying a second rosary. We are encouraged to try to follow the traditional calendar, even though it's no longer through justice towards God, now is an act of love of God. The second precept of the church we already saw earlier when we looked at the mass attendance on Sundays under the third commandment. The third precept of the church is the obligation to confess our sins at least once a year. Obviously, that's the bare minimum. Ideally, we should get to confession once a month. If you're able to get confession every other week, you can actually gain a plenary indulgence every day. The fourth precept is the obligation to receive Holy Communion during the Easter season. In the United States, the Easter season begins on the first Sunday of Lent and ends on Trinity Sunday. Deliberately to neglect one's Easter communion would be a mortal sin, simply because if we want to stay close to Jesus, we need to receive him body, blood, soul, and divinity in Holy Communion. Also, to receive communion only sacrilegiously during the Easter season would be an extra mortal sin against the precept. The fifth law of the church is to support the church according to one's means. Now, the Catholic Church is a good mother and understands that not all her children are in the same financial boat. Some people are able to give more than 10%. Others can give only the widow's mite. The church does not insist on a strict 10% tithe like certain Protestant denominations do. So as long as everyone's doing what they honestly can do to help the church, God will make sure it works out for the church in the long run. Because remember that your tithe does actually help with the buying of the hosts and altar wine that's used in the sacrifice of the Mass. The tithe helps to heat and cool the church, electricity, insurance, etc. Now, the sixth precept, the last precept, are laws concerning matrimony. A Catholic must be married by a Catholic priest in front of two witnesses. If a Catholic attempts marriage by a justice of the peace, it is an invalid marriage. Now, please note that only Catholics are bound to these laws of matrimony. A non-Catholic can be married by whoever, by a justice of the peace, by a Protestant minister, a Buddhist bonds, you know, whatever. And as long as it's their first and they're not already married, obviously, then God would accept that as a valid marriage. The reason why the Catholic Church demands a higher rung from Catholics is because we've got the true faith, and therefore, we have to make sure of certain things before our marriages are valid in God's eyes. To attend an invalid marriage, so for example, a Catholic who is divorced and attempting remarriage, or also a Catholic who is being married outside the Catholic Church. These are invalid marriages. So we are not allowed to attend an invalid marriage, normally speaking. Likewise, normally it's not even allowed to attend the reception after an invalid marriage because it implies that we're approving of the sin committed against God. So if you're ever stuck in this situation, and there are different circumstances, that's why I say this. So if you're stuck in this situation, and I think everyone at least once in their life is going to come across this case, speak to a priest about it, because occasionally there are certain circumstances that can allow it for one reason or another, even if the general rule is that we're not allowed to. Good. We've seen these commandments of God and the precepts of the church. Let's ask the Blessed Virgin Mary, God's mother and ours, to give us a great love for God and for God's law.